Many of you know that a couple weekends ago, I went back to the Pacific Northwest where I was born and raised, to a little town called Forks, Washington, where my grandmother and grandfather raised my mother and her six siblings. I was there for my grandma's funeral, with all the usual accompanying rituals along the way. And I didn't spend a lot of time with my grandma growing up, but I've always felt a certain kind of connection with her because we looked alike. I only knew her as an older woman, however, far from my own age, so the resemblance seemed to me only faint. But then, because you go through all the stuff when the second parent dies, all the photos were out. And there, staring back at me from the display in the church social hall, were my own eyes, my furrowed brow, high forehead, wide shoulders, first as a young newlywed, but then aging and changing just as I have and was starting to think I will in the next few decades. Even more than the huge look-alike factor were the echoes of our values and life choices. A champion of the marginalized and poor, a fierce advocate of both choice in religious life as well as faithfulness to religious commitments, a stubborn worker with a plan in mind for how things should go and would go, tireless in her carrying out her call to care for the physically and spiritually hungry. One of my favorite stories told after her funeral was from a man who worked with her in establishing the town's first food bank. He was a naysayer when it came to believing that they could raise the necessary money. It was a lot. But my grandmother was insistent. She said it was necessary, and so they would raise the money. He said she spoke at every place she could to come up with the money, and lo and behold, she was right and he was wrong. They raised the money, and the food bank exists still today. Reading the details of her life and hearing the stories told, I felt just as Rebecca Parker describes. I received who I was before I chose who I would become. My life was given to me. I did not make myself. I fell into communion with this line, this tradition, and simply picked it up and have tried to carry it forward as best I can. Of course, the weekend was not only filled with stories of my happy inheritance. All families, certainly including my own, are filled with things that you hope you can leave behind, or at least transform into goodness once and for all. There were many moments where I said to myself, try not to do that. Or, be careful, that's what an otherwise good quality can look like when taken to an extreme. Regardless of my good intentions, however, I concede there will be pieces of my inheritance from my grandmother and from my other parts of my family of origin that I wish would not follow me, and yet will. I try all the time to shake my mother's and my grandmother's ultra seriousness and headiness. I try to get more in my body and have more fun. I know all the rest that comes more naturally gets better when I do. But I confess, these and other patterns are embedded more deeply than I'd like. By nurture and by nature, I have been carefully taught. Most of us understand this about families. We understand how our lives are determined in so many ways by the patterns and relationships that we inherit and are raised with. We don't always realize, however, how this can also be true for other communities as well. Our places of employment, for example, we begin work someplace and we bring our own ideas and story into the mix, but the story that is already there can have a huge influence on us, whether we're aware of it or not. And often we're not. Before seminary, I oversaw six different offices that were spread throughout Colorado and New Mexico, and it was fascinating to see the ways that the trends would repeat themselves, even across employees who had never met. Each office had its own story that would repeat and repeat as if it was a script we gave to employees when they were hired, as if it was in the walls. And for most offices, this was a good thing. They were strong and healthy and relevant to their local communities and to our corporate purpose. But for one of the offices in Albuquerque, we struggled, like with employee after employee, it was caught in this story of deception and negativity. I swear the employees did not start that way when I hired them. But no matter what we did, I just could not figure out how to break the cycle. Churches, too, hold their own often repeated patterns. It's eerie the ways that churches will repeat situations even across generations. Not always in exactly the same ways, but often pretty close. It's one of the reasons that when the Reverend Rob Eller Isaacs was here a few weeks ago, one of the first things he did with the board was to read aloud that statement of purpose that we all read earlier in the service. And it's one of the reasons that when he and I met later, he asked me what my plan was for the long-held story of scarcity that we have in this congregation. He said, "It's in the DNA, and that's a problem." Now, you may have seen what he means as you were walking the timeline. These repeated moments of panic where we go, "Might have to close up shop, there's not enough money." Right? I think it happened 3 or 4 times across our congregation's life. This is just one of the stories that we have walked into, all of us, and all of us. None of you probably realized it when you first arrived, but this place is filled with stories, patterns that are like my Albuquerque office in the walls, and as of right now, literally on our walls. Which is very good news for all of us. Because though, as James Baldwin said, not everything that is faced can be changed, nothing can be changed until it is faced. Whether we're talking family systems or the places we work or our congregational histories, our best and only hope for having a say in our own future is by continually getting clear about our past. Only as we become conscious about the story that we're stepping into and the patterns we may inadvertently repeat, that covenant we have inherited, can we make intentional choices about when and how to collude with these habits and histories, and when and how to change them and let them go. This was my answer to Rob's question, by the way. We have to help people know about our story of scarcity, better understand it, and understand what values are at work within it, what competing commitments it reveals. And then, only then, can we actively choose to transform our story with any likelihood of success. We have to know what we're up against, the forces that are pulling on us. And then from our same history, we have to lift up counterexamples, like the generous giving in our recent reverse offering effort, so that we can know and remember that we are more than one thing. In this reviewing and reframing, we can better claim for ourselves, for example, a story of abundance, a story where our congregation is spiritually and financially strong and visionary and filled with gifts that we are ready to share. In theological terms, this whole process falls squarely within the field of constructive historicism, which imagines that the most life-giving truth is discernible and creatable by way of actively engaging with our past and then reconstructing our inheritance to liberate us into a new future. This is what Delwyn Brown, who I've quoted on the cover of the Order of Service today, what he advocates for. He's a constructive historicist. An active and explicit dialogue between past and present as a way of creating the future. Now you can see the seeds of this idea in our founding statement of purpose, cherishing the spiritual traditions of the past, but keeping itself open to all new light. But this statement doesn't go far enough. It actually doesn't arrive at the dialogue between past and present. It falls short of that more explicitly constructive historicism. Constructive historicism would have us not just cherishing the past, but interrogating it, transforming it in light of the needs of today and the call of our future. Not just keeping open to new light, but using the gifts of the past to create, to be that light. To bring this back to the everyday, I think about people who I know who have made significant breaks from their family patterns. Now, I don't just mean simply breaks in political affiliation or religion, as I know many, many of us may have. These are important and often challenging breaks in their own right, of course. But more, I mean those who have broken family relational patterns, like managed to make marriage work despite a huge pattern of family in their family of broken relationships, or raised healthy children regardless of having abusive or addicted parents themselves, or remained faithful in love and in friendship even though they may have been abandoned by those that they should have been able to trust the most. Watching someone break free in these sorts of ways is stunning and beautiful. In the cases I have witnessed, this kind of change doesn't happen without an explicit assessment of the past in all of its pain and possibility. Transformation like this requires an intimate excavation, traversing the landscape of your life, your own and your family's. It's not usually pretty. It's hard, even brutal work, requiring courage and commitment, honesty and clarity, reframing and reclaiming, forgiveness and grace. And this sort of work is never really done. The present, after all, is always asking something new, and the insights of the past are always bringing new discoveries as they get applied to today. This is the dialogue, past to present, back and forth, shaping one another. And yet a commitment to such active reconstruction and creativity yields a deeply liberated and liberating life. It just makes for really good people. Which brings me to this particular moment in our current trip around the sun. According to one website I found, nearly half of all Americans will make New Year's resolutions. Even those who don't will likely still find themselves reflecting on what they hope for in the new year. Of those who do make resolutions, about half of those report that they're successful about half of the time. So they lose their weight, they get organized, they spend less, save more, learn something new, find love, help others more, spend more time with their families. All of these, by the way, are the most common things that people listed as their resolutions for this past year. Maybe one of them was yours for 2014. How did you do? About half of the time. As we greet the new year and consider our individual as well as our shared hopes or resolutions for our future, let us continue to consider the past. Let us look with openness at the habits and patterns, commitments and traditions that we carry with us and why. Without judgment or guilt or shame, just honest clarity for who we have been, the story we've been in, the one we've inherited, where it came from. Maybe for some of us, getting just a little clearer on our personal stories will be plenty of resolution for this year. Maybe for some, that resolution will simply be to surface more of that story that we fell into, to seek some help from others, for like fish in the ocean, we can't always see the water in which we swim. Small groups can be good for this kind of work. In fact, for all of the reasons that for a church to exist today, helping people become more self-aware seems to me one of the most important. For here is the birthplace of personal and societal transformation. Once we have a little bit of clarity on our past, however, then we can begin that active dialogue between past and present so that we can better imagine and create our future. Then we can actively decide if we will become our parents or grandparents. distant cousins or troubled uncles. And only then do we have any chance of actually creating a future of our own.